Chapter 2. Women at the Gates. Misogyny in Ancient Rome. Roman women were the Greek male nightmare come true. They defied the misogynistic dictate, attributed to the Athenian statesman Pericles, that a good woman is one who is not talked about, even in praise. Obeying this had consigned the good women of 5th century BC Athens to complete oblivion. Today, not a single one is known by name. But the women of Rome made themselves known. A few have been talked about ever since. Messalina, whose name became synonymous with sexual excess. Agrippina, the woman of ruthless, unnatural ambition, who murdered her way to the top. Sempronia, the intellectual who abandoned the female sphere to enter the dangerous male world of conspiracy and revolution. Cleopatra, the brilliant seductress who plotted to rule the empire and plunged it into civil war. And Julia, the emperor's rebellious daughter who defied her father's plans and threw the state into crisis. They emerged from the pages of Rome's historians and poets as flesh-and-blood examples of how men viewed women. Much of what is said about them is far from flattering. But men's vitriol proves as powerful a historical preservative for women as does their desire. These recorded sentiments are an indication of the impact women made and the obstacles they overcame, including some of the most fearsome misogynistic laws ever codified. The Romans were not original thinkers. They did not produce a new theory or philosophy to justify the oppression and dehumanization of women. The stereotypes that evolved in Greek culture were good enough for them, as they have been for many succeeding cultures, including our own. But Roman writers allow us to see behind them. In the literary and historical portraits of the handful of extraordinary women who helped shape one of the greatest civilizations the world has ever seen, we get a glimpse of their struggle to assert themselves. A difference quickly emerges between the misogyny of the Greeks and that found in Rome. Greek misogyny is based on fears of what women might do if they were free to do it. However, as far as is known, if women challenged men, these actions were confined to their private world and only made public through the realm of the Greek imagination. But from the start, Roman women openly challenged the prevailing misogyny and made public their feelings and demands. Roman women protested their fate and took to the streets. In Rome, the veil of their anonymity was lifted. Women entered the public sphere and made history. They intervened in wars and stopped them. They took to the streets in protest at government policy and changed it. They murdered their husbands. A few trained and fought as gladiators in the arena, evoking worrying images of Amazons. They subverted the authority of their fathers. They even sought personal satisfaction in their relationships and rejected their role as breeders of rulers. And perhaps most disturbingly of all, they came tantalizingly close to political power. They provoked a backlash which mustered some of the biggest guns that literature and history have ever aimed at them. The context in which this battle was waged was the greatest and most successful empire the world has ever produced, an empire of some 60 million people that at its peak stretched from Scotland to Iraq and embraced a bewildering variety of cultures and peoples. Rome, its capital, was the largest city that had ever existed, with a population in the 1st century AD of between 1 and 2 million. It was the New York of its day, a city of savage spectacles and immense grandeur, teeming with people of different races from every corner of the vast, sprawling empire. Of those millions, only a comparatively few names have been preserved. They are overwhelmingly the names of those who made up society's upper echelons, contending for honour, power and wealth in a theatre every bit as dangerous and bloody as that of the arena, where gladiators fought to their deaths under the burning Roman sun to the cheers and howls of the Roman mob. It is in this arena of the ruling class that, over 2,000 years later, we find the names of nearly all of the Roman women still known to us. They were defined by their relationships to men, as daughters, sisters, mistresses, wives, and mothers. Like the heroines of the Greek tragedies, they fought to promote the interests of their kith and kin. But this was no play. In Rome, it was a matter of life and death. As in Greece, the first major obstacle that a woman faced in life was the threat of being deprived of it at birth. In Rome, this threat was codified in a way that encouraged female infanticide. Laws attributed to Romulus, the city's mythological founder, decreed that only every male child and the firstborn female be reared, an invitation to expose other daughters born afterwards. Marriage was the next hurdle for women, which they faced upon reaching puberty. In early Rome, circa the 7th century BC, they were subject to some of the most oppressive marriage laws imaginable. As a wife, a woman was placed under the absolute rule of her husband, who had the power of life or death over her. Sitting in judgment with his wife's relatives, a husband was given power to pass sentence in cases of adultery, and if any wife was found drinking wine, Romulus allowed the death penalty for both crimes. If ever there was a law that actively encouraged wife battering, this was it. Egnatius Metellus, the bearer of one of the great aristocratic names in Roman history, was held up as a sterling example of how a man should act in a good marriage. Once, he arrived home to find his wife drinking wine. He promptly took a cudgel and bludgeoned her to death. According to the historian Valerius Maximus, not only did no one charge him with a crime, but no one even blamed him. Everyone considered this an excellent example of one who had justly paid the penalty for violating the laws of sobriety. Indeed, any woman who immoderately seeks the use of wine closes the door on all virtues and opens it to vices. Valerius Maximus also quotes with approval Gaius Sulpicius Gallus, who divorced his wife because he caught her with her hair uncovered in public. In words that could have been uttered by a 21st-century Saudi Arabian prince, he explained, "The law prescribes for you my eyes alone, to which you may prove your beauty. For these eyes you should provide the ornaments of beauty. For these be lovely." Another example is given of the man who divorced his wife when he saw her talking to a woman friend who was an ex-slave, on the grounds that such female liaisons nourished potential wrongdoing, and it was better to prevent the sin from being committed than to punish it afterwards. The laws also allowed the death penalty to be imposed on a daughter-in-law for striking her father-in-law. Needless to say, the power of divorce was granted only to the husband. The Romans inherited the Greek preoccupation with female virtue and linked it to the honour of the family and the welfare of the state. The most famous example of an early Roman matron's virtue in action was that of Lucretia, a model of female behaviour much alluded to by moralists in the later decadent years of the empire. She remains an example of the dangers women faced when expected to live up to moral standards based on the misogynistic notion which equates sexual purity in women with goodness. Lucretia's husband Collatinus made the mistake of boasting about her goodness to the lustful king of Rome, Tarquinius Superbus. Reverence for something is frequently accompanied by the urge to defile it. Symbols of sexual purity probably arouse lust more often than pornographic images. Driven by the urge to profane this example of matronly virtue, Tarquinius threatens Lucretia that if she does not sleep with him, he will murder both her and her slave and leave their naked corpses in the same bed. Knowing the humiliation and horror that would fall upon her husband and family if it were thought she had made love to a slave, Lucretia chooses the lesser of the two evils. Even though clearly forced to endure Tarquinius's lust, under Roman law she is still guilty of adultery. After telling her story to her husband and her family, she stabs herself to death. Like so many women who have suffered rape, Lucretia blamed herself, and as St. Augustine so wisely pointed out, punished herself for the wrongs inflicted by others. Misogyny always confronts women with the same dilemma. Whether they are good girls or bad girls, they are forced into the same conundrum. They still arouse lust in men for which they, not those who desire them, are held responsible. The story had a happy ending for Rome, if not for poor Lucretia. Enraged, Romans overthrew Tarquinius and ended the rule of kings. They established the Republic, which was to last nearly 5 centuries before it gave way to imperial autocracy. But Lucretia has continued to be used as an example throughout the centuries to bully women into accepting that they are worth nothing more than their virtue. Early Rome also presents us on a massive scale with the first example of date rape in human history. Moreover, the rape of the Sabine women set the precedent for future acts of political intervention by women. Short of women, the founders of Rome invited people from the neighbouring Sabine tribe to a party. At a given signal from Romulus, the Romans seized the best-looking young women and carried them off. According to the historian Livy, the Romans treated the captive women with delicacy. Romulus persuaded them to stay and marry their captors. The most unbelievable part of the entire story is that he did so by reading them the Roman marriage laws to show how superior their laws were to those of the Sabines. A war ensued between the Sabines, intent on revenge, and the Romans. At one point in the battle, not wishing to see their new husbands fighting with their brothers and fathers, the Sabine women thrust themselves between the ranks and brought hostilities to a halt. The Romans accepted this tale as part of the city's early history, crediting the women with achieving in reality what Aristophanes portrayed only as fantasy in his comedy Lysistrata, where he tells how the women of Greece went on a sex strike to stop the Peloponnesian War. Until the time of Julius Caesar, a temple dedicated to the fortune of women stood on the Via Latina that runs south out of Rome. It commemorated women's intervention in another war, after Rome had banished one of its most successful generals, Coriolanus, because of his overweening arrogance. In revenge, he led an army of the city's enemies against his home. As he approached the city, ready to shed the blood of his fellow citizens, all seemed lost, until a delegation of Roman women, including his mother and wife, blocked his path and persuaded him to turn back. The city was saved, and thanks to women, again a costly war was ended. Though they lived under oppressive laws, Roman women were never kept in the Oriental-style seclusion to which Greek women were subjected. Greek visitors to Rome commented with some amazement on the differences. One such was Cornelius Nepos, who journeyed to Rome in the 1st century BC and observed, "Much that in Rome we held to be correct is thought shocking in Greece. No Roman thinks it an embarrassment to take his wife to a dinner party. At home, the wife holds first place in the house and is the centre of its social life. Things are very different in Greece, where the wife is never present at dinner unless it is a family party, and spends all her time in a remote part of the house called the women's quarter, which is never entered by a man unless he is a very close relation." In an even more shocking display of their freedom, Roman women extended their tradition of public intervention to protesting on the streets. They launched the first recorded public protest movement ever organized by women. In 205 BC, during a war with the Carthaginian general Hannibal, Rome passed the Oppian Laws, legislation curtailing the amount of gold women could possess and restricting public displays of decoration and luxury in women's dress. 10 years later, with Carthage safely vanquished, Roman upper-class women demanded to know why the Oppian Laws were still on the statute books. After much agitation to abolish them, the Senate decided to debate the issue. On the day of the debate, the women flocked into the forum where the Senate House, the ancient seat of government, still stands, to lobby for their demands. The main opponent to the repeal was Cato the Elder, the most formidable orator of his time. Cato was a nouveau riche, but he identified with Rome's founding fathers and old aristocracy, expounding the ancient virtues of hard work, abstemiousness, and plain living which, he claimed, had made Rome great. Like many a professional Puritan, he paraded his simple lifestyle with great ostentation. According to the historian Livy, as recorded in the early history of Rome, in a misogynistic tour de force, Cato declared, "If every married man had been concerned to ensure that his own wife looked up to him and respected his rightful position as her husband, we should not have half this trouble with women en masse. Instead, women have become so powerful that our independence has been lost in our own homes and is now being trampled and stamped underfoot in public. We have failed to restrain them as individuals, and now they have combined to reduce us to our present panic. It made me blush to push my way through a positive regiment of women a few minutes ago in order to get here. My respect for the position and modesty of them as individuals, a respect which I do not feel for them as a mob, prevented my doing anything as consul which would suggest the use of force. Otherwise I should have said to them, 'What do you mean by rushing out in public in this unprecedented fashion, blocking the streets and shouting out to men who are not your husbands? Could you not have asked your questions at home, and have asked them of your husbands? Woman is a violent and uncontrolled animal, and it is no good giving her the reins and expecting her not to kick over the traces. No, you have got to keep the reins firmly in your own hands. Suppose you allow them to acquire or to extort one right after another, and in the end to achieve complete equality with men. Do you think that you will find them bearable? Nonsense. Once they have achieved equality, they will be your masters. Cato's speech failed. The Senate voted to overturn the Oppian laws. But the same basic argument has been used ever since to deny women everything from the vote to access to birth control. Cato states it with startling clarity. Give women freedom in one sphere, and the floodgates of immorality will open in all the others. Within a decade of the repeal of the Oppian laws, an extraordinary scandal rocked Rome, which Livy, writing at a later, more decadent period, uses as proof that Cato was right. It led to a ferocious crackdown on unorthodox religious practices, foreshadowing the witch hunts of the Middle Ages. Roman state religion was a very masculine affair. It involved the appeasement of dominant gods through prescribed ritual and sacrifice. Cults were divided along class lines. Practices that allowed patricians and plebeians to mix socially were frowned upon. Several cults were in the care of women. The goddess Fortuna, for example, was meant to bring women luck in their sex lives. There was an altar dedicated to plebeian chastity, which Livy laments was much neglected. The most famous women's cult was that of the Vestal Virgins. Vesta was the goddess of the hearth. She guarded the sacred eternal flame of Rome that burned in the deepest recesses of her temple, one of the most beautiful in the Forum. Six Vestals, selected from the noblest families, tended the flame. According to an ancient and deeply rooted belief, should it go out, Rome would fall. Any Vestal who allowed this to occur was scourged. Any who lost her virginity during her tenure, which lasted 30 years, was buried alive. Freud has suggested that women were entrusted to protect the eternal flame because, given their anatomy, they were less likely to urinate on it to extinguish it. Whether or not this was the case, by 186 BC the traditional Roman cults were tempting fewer women. Increasingly, Eastern mystery religions, and such cults as that of Bacchus, were attracting devotees and becoming especially appealing to women, offering an emotional release from the stifling moral regime under which they lived. As recounted by Livy, in 186 BC, a former slave girl confessed to the authorities that she had been involved in the cult of Bacchus, the wine god, whose worship had spread to Rome from Greece. Prompted by fears for her lover, who was under pressure from his mother to join the cult, the freedwoman painted a lurid picture of Roman matrons gathering by night to indulge in wine binges and orgiastic sex. Unnatural sex acts had become normal and, she claimed, were part of the initiation rites. Anyone who resisted the cult's sexual demands was killed and their bodies secretly buried. Women from the most distinguished families, dressed up in animal skins as devotees of Bacchus, got drunk, became possessed, and, with loose hair flowing wildly behind them, went racing through the night, crying and screaming gibberish. The cult followers came from all social classes, including slaves. For the Romans, always on the lookout for slave rebellion, such a gathering would have seemed socially as well as sexually subversive, a threat to the prevailing order. The former slave's frightening tale strikingly resembles the accusations of sexual abandonment and promiscuity brought against medieval women thought to be witches. The female Bacchae, like the later women accused of witchcraft, were accused of murdering anyone who defied them, including their children. Some were said to perform black magic. We see the portrait of the medieval witch taking shape. Women, young and beautiful, or hags with serpents entwined in their hair, abandoning themselves in drunken orgies, making hellish concoctions at the dead of night out of the blood of frogs, bones, and the remains of children they have murdered. This misogynistic portrait of female wickedness was born some 12 centuries before the first witch was burned in Europe. The Roman authorities arrested and executed the men and handed over the women cultists to their families, where the paterfamilias administered the death penalty. As many as 7,000 people were arrested and executed. The association of upper-class women with plots and conspiracies preoccupied another Roman historian, Sallust, 86-35 BC. In 63 BC, a gang of reckless patricians, driven to desperation by debt, conspired to overthrow the state and seize power. At their head was Lucius Catiline, a man whom Sallust, in his account of the plot, describes as being of powerful intellect and great physical strength, but having a vicious and depraved nature. Sallust, himself a failed revolutionary, singled out one aspect of the conspiracy as especially worrying. About this time, Catiline is said to have gained many adherents of every condition, including a number of women who in their earlier days had lived extravagantly on money by prostituting themselves, and then, when advancing age reduced their incomes without changing their luxurious tastes, had run headlong into debt. These women, he thought, would do good service by acting as agitators among the city slaves and organizing acts of incendiarism. Their husbands, too, could be either induced to join his cause or murdered. Only one of these upper-class prostitutes turned revolutionaries is named, Sempronia. Descended from one of the most renowned families in Rome, she was a woman who had committed many crimes that showed her to have the reckless daring of a man. Fortune had favoured her abundantly, not only with birth and beauty, but with a good husband and children. Well educated in Greek and Latin literature, she had greater skill in lyre playing and dancing than there is any need for a respectable woman to acquire. There was nothing that she set a smaller value on than seemliness and chastity. Her passions were so ardent that she more often made advances to men than they did to her. Many times already she had broken a solemn promise, repudiated a debt by perjury, and been an accessory to murder. Yet her abilities were not to be despised. She could write poetry, crack a joke, and converse at will with decorum, tender feeling, or wantonness. She was, in fact, a woman of ready wit and considerable charm. Sempronia was for a time Julius Caesar's mistress, and one of her children, Decimus Brutus, was widely rumoured to be Caesar's. Brutus was more successful as a conspirator than his mother, being one of the group of assassins who murdered Caesar in 44 BC. Catiline's plot was betrayed, and the conspirators executed. However, Sempronia escaped unscathed, and later historians have questioned Sallust's allegations of her complicity. What is not in doubt is the mixture of disapproval and powerful fascination with which the historian rendered Sempronia's portrait. Dancing, writing poetry, having affairs, plotting with revolutionaries, stirring up slaves. It is certain that had there been marijuana in Rome, Sempronia would have smoked it. She is the prototype of the bohemian intellectual woman against whom, in all her many manifestations, moralists for centuries will rant and rail. In Sallust's eyes, her real fault was that she was a modern woman. His account is meant to be a warning of what happens when women pursue pleasure as openly as do men. Women's taste for extravagance leads them into sexual misbehaviour, which in turn transforms them into desperate revolutionaries, prepared even to consort with slaves. No more anxious and worrisome association was imaginable for Roman rulers than that between rebellious women and restless slaves. In the years following the failed conspiracy, Rome was convulsed by the horrors of a civil war which finally brought down the republican form of government and replaced it with the one-family rule of the Caesars. As a handful of powerful families began to struggle for dominance over the growing empire and political action in the public arena became more dangerous, women were forced back into a more familiar area of competition. Access to power meant access to the ruler or a likely prospect. It meant the struggle to promote the prospects of their offspring, especially the males. The closer to the source of power they were, the deadlier the struggle became, providing the moralizing misogynists of Imperial Rome with an entire gallery of female rogues who defied the standards of modesty, restraint, and passivity expected of the traditional matron. The most notable of these women who cast a long shadow over the twilight years of the Republic could not be expected to be an icon of matronly values. Indeed, Cleopatra, 69-30 BC, was not even a Roman, but an Egyptian pharaoh who was a direct descendant of one of Alexander the Great's Macedonian generals. Romans seized on her as dramatic proof of the evils of allowing women to have an influence on matters of state and of public policy. They helped make Cleopatra one of perhaps the two women from the ancient world, the other being Helen of Troy, whose name is still recognisable to ordinary people today. The deep impression that Cleopatra made on Roman and Greek historians, poets and chroniclers was passed on to Shakespeare, Bernard Shaw and Hollywood, where, as portrayed by Elizabeth Taylor, she was the subject of one of the biggest flops in the history of filmmaking. Cleopatra was the descendant of Ptolemy, one of the Macedonian generals who inherited parts of the vast empire of Alexander the Great upon his death in 323 BC. She was the product of the Hellenistic period, which begins with Alexander's death and ends in 30 BC with her suicide and the absorption of Egypt into the Roman Empire. During the intervening three centuries, Greek women had escaped from many of the suffocating restrictions of the classical period and enjoyed improvements in their status, including more liberal marriage contracts and educational opportunities. They also took a more prominent role in political affairs. Cleopatra was the last and most famous of a line of Hellenistic queens who took part in the dynastic battles which raged for control of the remains of Alexander's empire. Her affairs with Julius Caesar, and after his assassination with his lieutenant Mark Antony, have become the stuff of tragedy, high romance, and Hollywood kitsch. Both men were charmed more by her wit and intelligence than by her beauty. According to the biographer Plutarch, she could speak 10 languages, converse with Caesar into the small hours of the morning, and respond in kind to the bawdy banter of Antony. She was the only one of the long line of Ptolemies who could speak the native language of Egypt. Her lively intellect extended into many spheres. She even penned a treatise on hairdressing and cosmetics. But to her contemporaries in Rome, she was a devious, bewitching, and overweeningly ambitious seductress who had to be stopped at all costs. In the contest between Octavian and Antony for absolute imperial power, his enemies portrayed the latter as a gormless soldier. The accusation that she was using Antony to gain control of the empire became a vital part of Octavian's propaganda. As with Sempronia, Cleopatra's enemies linked her intellectual independence to her wanton sexuality. It was typical of the age-old campaign to prove that women who are smart enough to think for themselves have no morals, or if they have, will surely lose them. So Horace and other Roman poets of the period directed their invective at her alleged promiscuity. She was nicknamed in Greek Meriokhane, which means she who parts for a thousand men. In a pornographic fantasy that eclipses Debbie Does Dallas, her detractors have her performing fellatio on 100 Roman nobles in one day. Antony was clearly comfortable with accomplished and intelligent women. His wife Fulvia was the daughter of Sempronia and has been described by one modern historian as an Amazon. His political enemies used this as proof that he had been unmanned by such women and therefore was not fit to rule the empire. After Antony's defeat in 31 BC, Cleopatra tried to seduce Octavian, but he stayed away from her. Rather than be dragged to Rome in chains to grace his triumph, she committed suicide. However, Cleopatra lives on, while the obscenities intended to insult her are seen now for what they were, and instead demean the men who made them. It is her wit and charm that triumphed in the end, as celebrated by Shakespeare in some of the most famous lines ever written about a woman. Age cannot wither her, nor custom stale her infinite variety. Other women cloy the appetite they feed, but she makes hungry where most she satisfies. For vilest things become themselves in her, that the holy priests bless her for when she is riggish. As the Roman Republic passed into history, a few women made their voices heard publicly as speakers and advocates, much to the outrage of the historian Valerius Maximus. We must be silent no longer about these women, whom neither the condition of their nature nor the cloak of modesty could keep silent in the forum and the courts, he wrote. Thanks to his determination to register his disapproval, we know they existed. Most notable among them was Hortensia, the daughter of one of Rome's greatest orators, Quintus Hortensius. In an incident that has gone into the history books as a mere footnote, she used her eloquence to directly intervene in political affairs. By 42 BC in Rome, the powerful triumvirate of Mark Antony, Octavian, later to become the Emperor Augustus, and Marcus Lepidus ruled as a three-man dictatorship, mercilessly purging their political opponents, 2,300 of whom were arrested and executed. Starved for cash, the triumvirate imposed a heavy tax on 1,400 upper-class women. The women marched in protest and tried to speak to the womenfolk of the three rulers, hoping for a sympathetic hearing. They were only partially successful, but managed to force their way into the forum to the speaker's rostrum. According to Valerius Maximus, no man dared take their case. Hortensia stepped forward and pleaded their case before the triumvirs, both firmly and successfully. Something remarkable then happened, both in the history of misogyny and in the history of women, which to a large extent is the story of the struggle against misogyny. For the first time, the question of franchise was raised, if only by implication. During her powerful speech, which focuses on the sufferings of women during war, Hortensia asks, "Why should we pay taxes when we have no part in the honours, the commands, the statecraft for which you contend against each other with such harmful results?" Though there is no outright demand for extending the vote to women, Hortensia's words come very close to the demand the American revolutionaries voiced many centuries later: no taxation without representation. The women's protest of 42 BC is the high point of their public activism in Rome, and the last such demonstration they ever undertook in this era. It is also the last public protest by women aimed at political change that we know about in the history of Western civilization until the 19th century. Then the rise of the suffragette movement made the demand for the vote central to the campaign for women's rights. Out of the turmoil that destroyed the Republic and replaced it with one-family rule came the conservative backlash against women. Fretting at women's freedoms, moralists took up the refrain, "Less lust and bigger families." No sooner had Octavian become the Emperor Augustus in 27 BC than the historian Livy began to write his History of Rome, as seen from the winner's point of view, and expressed clearly the new regime's moral intentions. "I hope everyone will pay keen attention to the moral life of earlier times, and will appreciate the subsequent decline in discipline and in moral standards, the collapse and disintegration of morality down to the present day. For we have now reached a point where our degeneracy is intolerable, and so are the measures by which alone it can be reformed." As in the 1960s and 1970s, the problem was that women were having fewer children but more sex. The resurgence of the family values movement was an attempt to reverse that trend. The Roman state, however, had more coercive power than the moral majoritarians of 1980s America. The old strict form of marriage, which had placed a wife under the absolute authority of her husband, lapsed with the centuries and was replaced by more informal arrangements. Clearly, husbands were no longer made of the stern stuff of Rome's founding fathers and had grown too tolerant over the years. Some were refusing to divorce their wives when they caught them in adultery. A few husbands were accused of even profiting by it. Liberalism of this sort was judged to be the cause of the rot which moralists saw all around them. Augustus drafted a series of laws, known as the Lex Julia, aimed at encouraging men and women to marry and at restoring the traditional Roman family. Augustus imposed penalties on those who had not married by a certain age and rewarded those who did and fathered children. He revived the ancient law allowing fathers to kill their daughters and husbands their wives if caught in the sexual act. Husbands were again obliged to divorce their adulterous wives or face severe penalties. Augustus took the jurisdiction of adultery cases away from the family and handed it over to a public court. Divorce was not enough. Augustus wanted erring wives dragged through the courts and punished. The wronged husband was given 60 days after the divorce to prosecute his former wife. If he proved too soft-hearted, she could still be prosecuted by any member of the public who was above the age of 25, surely one of the greatest encouragements ever codified for self-righteous busybodies who enjoyed the spectacle of a woman being publicly disgraced. Although the new law allowed a woman to divorce her husband for adultery, it did not oblige her to do so, and she was barred from bringing a criminal prosecution against him. That is, adultery was a public offence only for women. The new laws also made it an offence for a man to have sexual relations with any woman outside of marriage, except a prostitute. Applied to upper-class women, it meant they were not permitted to have any form of sexual liaison at all unless they were married. In protest, some women put their names on the registry of prostitutes kept by the Roman authorities who oversaw the city's 35 official brothels. This desperate dodge was eliminated later when Tiberius, Augustus's successor, barred any woman who came from a respectable family, that is, middle class or senatorial, from registering as a prostitute. Augustus proclaimed this new legislation from the ancient rostrum, the speaker's platform in the forum, which he redecorated with marble and bronze ship's prows. They are the only laws passed in his long reign to which he gave his name, Julia, named in honour of his family, the Julian, into which Julius Caesar had adopted him, an indication of the importance he attached to them. It was one of his proudest moments as ruler. Augustus, it was declared, had refounded Rome. Shortly thereafter, in 2 BC, the Senate proclaimed him father of his country, the first Roman ever to receive this honour. But the Lex Julia was deeply unpopular. Given the moral freedoms Roman men and women enjoyed, a backlash against them was inevitable. For the proud emperor, it came in the most humiliating form imaginable. Within weeks, perhaps days of the Senate's proclamation, Julia, the 37-year-old daughter of the father of his country, made an incredible mockery of his laws and shook the foundations of the new moral order he had attempted to impose. Had there been a tabloid newspaper, its front page would doubtless have screamed, "Julia in orgy shock, sex romp on rostrum." According to the Stoic philosopher and imperial adviser Seneca, she had received lovers in droves. She had roamed the city in nocturnal revels, choosing for her pleasures the forum and the very rostrum from which her father had proposed the adultery law. She was accused of seeking every kind of gratification from casual lovers. She was even alleged to have hired herself out as a prostitute. The same allegations would later be made against Messalina, the wife of the Emperor Claudius. The anecdotes that survive about Julia, Augustus's only child, depict a witty, strong-willed young woman. Once her father commented unfavourably on the immodesty of her dress. The next day, when she appeared in proper attire, he complimented her, to which she replied, "Today I dressed for my father's eyes, yesterday for a man's." Daughters' talents or ambitions, however, were of little importance compared to their ability to produce sons. Between the ages of 14, when Julia was first married, and 28, she had 3 husbands, all chosen for her by her father, who was desperate to have a male heir. She must at times have felt like the imperial incubator. She dutifully produced 3 boys and 2 daughters, all with her second husband, Agrippa, her father's right-hand man, who was over twice her age when they married. But none of her sons survived to fulfil her father's dreams of finding a male heir of his own direct lineage. It was one of her 2 daughters, Agrippina, who would go on to produce a male heir to the throne, the Emperor Caligula. Julia's behaviour was more than just a wild fling. The orgy on the rostrum was timed, as well as placed, for maximum effect. The very year that Augustus was declared father of his country, his daughter demonstrated his complete failure as a father to his own family. She knew how a daughter can most keenly wound her father. Her promiscuity was the revenge of a daughter who rebelled in the only way that was open to her, to seek her own personal gratification, as Seneca notes with horror. She was playing sexual politics, forced to do so because her body had become a political commodity. Paradoxically, by giving it away, she was reclaiming it as her own. But Julia's acts were acts of political defiance as well as of personal protest. Augustus's laws were deeply unpopular, as Livy noted, nowhere more so than within the intellectual coterie in which Julia moved and from which evolved a countercultural rebellion. Something similar happened in America and other Western democracies with the sexual revolution of the 1960s against the conservative, family-oriented moral code of the previous decades. Augustus, enraged, did not try to keep the scandal secret. He dragged his daughter and her friends before the courts, accusing her of promiscuity, adultery, and prostituting herself. The court heard the full, lurid story. She was condemned. He banished her forever. She died 16 years later, without ever seeing him or Rome again. The stage was now set for one of the great creations of misogyny. Cato the Elder had warned his fellow Romans long ago, when women were demanding the right to wear gorgeous clothes, that "woman is a violent and uncontrolled animal, to whom any concession of freedom will lead to complete abandonment and the collapse of all moral standards." That fear was embodied in Messalina, the wife of the Emperor Claudius, 10 BC to AD 54. Messalina was the great-granddaughter of Augustus's sister Octavia, who married Mark Antony after Fulvia died. She married Claudius in AD 37, when she was probably still a teenager, though the year of her birth is not known for certain, and he was almost 47. 4 years later, after the assassination of Caligula, Claudius succeeded him to become emperor. He would last for 13 years. Perhaps the most unlikely of Rome's rulers, he is portrayed as a rather scholarly eccentric, maladroit, and consumed with the pursuit of arcane history. In dramatic contrast, his young wife has become identified with a psychosexual disorder. Excessive heterosexuality, promiscuity, or what is known as the Messalina complex. According to Havelock Ellis, one of the 20th century's most famous sex experts, sex is no real pleasure to the Messalina type. It's only an attempt to find relief from deeper unhappiness. You might call it a flight into sex. In modern times, various theories have been expounded to explain the Messalina type, from frigidity to thwarted maternal instincts to latent lesbianism. More recently, the whole notion of such a thing as nymphomania has been questioned. But the Messalina of history is more than a psychological category. Among other things, she is one of the outstanding examples of how prejudice works as a kind of reductionism. Messalina's historical importance stems from the fact that she was only the second woman to become a Roman empress. Her sole role model was Livia, the austere wife of Augustus, whose private life was as impeccable as any matron's. In but one thing, Messalina seems to have imitated her: her determination to get rid of anyone suspected of hostility to her or to her husband, or of harbouring ambitions to supplant her son Britannicus as Claudius's heir. In this, she was brutally efficient, eliminating potential rivals to Julio-Claudian dominance before they could act. But the Messalina that has come down to us is not the ruthless politician, but the nymphomaniac, largely thanks to the poet Juvenal's portrait of her in his Sixth Satire. In it, he accuses her of sneaking through the dark streets as soon as Claudius was asleep, her black hair disguised by a blonde wig, to enter a brothel. "Look at those peers of the gods, and hear what Claudius suffered. Soon as his august wife was sure that her husband was sleeping, this imperial whore preferred, to a bed in the palace, some low mattress, put on the hood she wore in the night-time, sneaked through the streets alone, or with only a single companion, hid her black hair in a blonde wig, and entered a brothel. Reek of old sheets, still warm, her cell was reserved for her, empty, held in the name of Lycisca. There she took off her dress, showed her golden tits, and the parts where Britannicus came from, took the customers on, with gestures more than inviting, asked and received her price, and had a wonderful evening. Then, when the pimp let the girls go home, she sadly departed, last of them all to leave, still hot with a woman's erection, tired by her men, but unsatisfied still, her cheeks all discoloured, rank with the smell of the lamps, filthy, completely disgusting, perfumed with the aroma of whorehouse, and home at last to her pillow." This portrait by Juvenal, AD 50 to 127, of rampant female sexuality has, like the myths of Pandora and Eve, become proverbial, reducing woman to a voracious vagina, forever unsatisfied. He also uses Messalina to generalize about women. Their appetites are all the same, no matter what class they come from. High or low, their lusts are all alike. But is his portrait also a myth? Juvenal was writing about 60 years after the reign of Claudius, and the new dynasty under which he lived was still very anti-Julio-Claudian. The virtuous Roman matron had made a comeback in the form of the wives of the emperors Trajan, AD 98-117, and Hadrian, 117-138. Besides, Juvenal was a satirist, holding up to ridicule the vices of mankind and society. The satiric method involves taking vices to extremes for comic as well as moral effect. Moralists in any age, whether it is 2nd century Rome or 21st century America, enjoy nothing so much as horrifying their audiences by playing on their deepest fears and prejudices. How much of a misogynist Juvenal himself was is open to debate, but he was certainly playing to the misogyny of his audience. He did so with remarkable eloquence, as have many misogynists before and since. Juvenal's sixth satire is yet another instance of what may at first appear to be a paradox about misogyny. It has inspired more great writing than any other prejudice. One cannot imagine anti-Semitism, or any other type of bigotry for that matter, producing good poetry. The paradox goes to the very heart of misogyny and its deepest contradiction. Juvenal's portrait of the woman of whom he so strongly disapproves is coloured by fascination and desire, and it is his desire and fascination, as much as his indignation, that make him eloquent. Messalina lasted 7 years at Claudius's side, during which time it appears he had no knowledge of her sexual adventures. The incident that precipitated her fall from power has perplexed historians. In AD 48, when the emperor was out of Rome, she married the lover who was her current favourite, a handsome aristocrat named Caius Silius, during a Bacchanalian festival. The theory that the marriage was part of a plot to replace Claudius as emperor flies in the face of Messalina's record of defending the interests of her son as future ruler. Why would she entrust Britannicus to the care of a stepfather who already had sons of his own? Her interests and his were best protected by ensuring Claudius survived. The historian Cornelius Tacitus has a more reasonable, less complicated explanation. Messalina's adultery was going so smoothly that she was drifting, through boredom, into unfamiliar vices. The idea of being called Silius's wife appealed to her, owing to its sheer outrageousness, a sensualist's ultimate satisfaction. Messalina's marriage was the moral equivalent of Julia's sex romp on the rostrum from which her father had pronounced his anti-adultery laws, a defiant act of sexual theatre. But it lacked Julia's political motivation. Messalina was quickly found out, and the list of her outrageous sexual misdemeanours handed over to Claudius by the emperor's staff, who were growing concerned at her increasing licence. She was ordered to commit suicide. But the young woman's nerve failed her, and an officer of the Praetorian Guard stabbed her to death. For a more contemporary account of Rome's first-century dynastic battles, we must turn to the dark, ironic genius of Tacitus, who broods over the years when the Julio-Claudian family was tightening its blood-stained grip on the administrative machinery that ran the vast empire. He provides us with extraordinary portraits of the early Caesars and their women. There is none more evocative than that of the woman who succeeded Messalina as empress, Julia Agrippina, the mother of Nero. Agrippina came closer to power than any Roman woman before or after her. Conservatives and misogynists used Agrippina's extraordinary rise to power as proof that Cato the Elder had been right when over 200 years earlier he had warned of the dangers of women's emancipation and the fear of their taking political power. Once they have achieved equality, they will be your masters. Agrippina was one of 9 children of Germanicus, the Emperor Tiberius's popular nephew, and Agrippina the Elder, one of the children of the first Julia, Augustus's doomed daughter. 6 children, 3 boys and 3 girls, survived into adulthood. Only one, Agrippina's younger sister Drusilla, died of natural causes. All the others were to die violently, victims of the dynastic struggles that shaped the early empire. Agrippina would live to be the sister, wife, and mother of emperors. Malicious gossip has it that she was the lover of all three. As the great-great-great-granddaughter of Julius Caesar's sister, Agrippina inherited an imperious tradition, one as fully realized in her ambitious character as it was in her mother's. Agrippina the Elder, while accompanying her husband on a campaign in Germany, had stopped a panicky legion from abandoning its post by effectively seizing command and holding an important Rhine crossing until Germanicus and his army returned from a dangerous expedition into the interior. Germanicus was the JFK of Rome, one of the great what-ifs of history, cheated of absolute power by an untimely and suspicious death. Agrippina's mother enjoyed the support of a powerful faction within Rome called by Tacitus the Party of Agrippina, which sought to advance her and her children's claims to supreme power. She had commanded troops, now she commanded a party. She earned herself the opprobrium of being called a masculine woman. But more than that, her masculine ambition inspired fear. Tiberius asked her, "My girl, do you think you are badly done by if you do not rule?" It finally drove him to exiling her. She starved herself to death in protest and died in AD 33. Her daughter, Julia Agrippina, was almost 18. She would live to provoke the same name-calling and inspire the same fears. The younger Agrippina married Claudius, her uncle and third husband, in AD 49, after a special law was passed making marriage between niece and uncle legal. "From this moment the country was transformed," wrote Tacitus. "Complete obedience was accorded to a woman, and not a woman like Messalina, who toyed with national affairs to satisfy her appetites. This was a vigorous, almost masculine despotism." Within a year, the new wife appeared on official coins alongside Claudius with the title Augusta, marking the first occasion on which the wife of a living emperor enjoyed this honour. "The significance of Agrippina's elevation cannot be exaggerated," wrote one historian. "Perhaps more than anything else, it conveyed the notion of empress, not, of course, in the technical sense of a person having the formal authority to make legally binding decisions, but as someone who could lay equal claim to the majesty that the office of emperor conveyed." In AD 51, after a long war in the new province of Britain, the Celtic rebel Caretacus was brought to Rome in chains. Agrippina appeared with the emperor to meet the triumphant legions and their prisoners, some of whom were freed. Tacitus noted, "Released from their chains, they offered to Agrippina, conspicuously seated on another dais nearby, the same homage and gratitude as they had given to the emperor. That a woman should sit before Roman standards was an unprecedented novelty. She was asserting her partnership in the empire her ancestors had won." Her privileges continued to accrue, including the right to receive the supplications of the courtiers and clients who paid homage to Claudius each morning. The sculpted heads of Agrippina from this period show her wearing a diadem, an unheard-of honour. At the same time as she was consolidating her power, she was advancing the interests of her son. Claudius formally adopted Nero as his own, thus placing him in front of his own son Britannicus, who was several years younger in the line of succession. Agrippina's rise to power, however, began to provoke fierce criticism and hostility. Eventually, Claudius began to take note. But Agrippina pounced first. In AD 54, Claudius died suddenly, almost certainly poisoned, and Nero was emperor just 2 months short of his 17th birthday. When the head of the palace guard asked the new emperor for a new password, he replied at once, "Optima mater." The best of mothers, a grimly ironic beginning for a reign that would be darkened by matricide. At first, Agrippina's political position seemed stronger than ever. Early on in her son's reign, imperial coins were issued in Rome, depicting mother and son facing one another, conveying the impression of joint rule for which no precedent existed in Roman law. More shocking still to Roman custom, a contemporary relief of the two shows Agrippina placing a laurel wreath, the symbol of military victory, on her son's head. Romans, of course, suspected that Nero was emperor thanks to his mother, but were appalled that it was so boldly acknowledged. Equally revolutionary was the decision to allow Agrippina to hear the proceedings of the Senate from behind a veiled enclosure specially constructed for the purpose. She had achieved the unthinkable. Public opposition to her was dangerous, but privately the muttering grew louder about her female arrogance. Agrippina's success in having her role publicly celebrated showed a character unable to accept the power-behind-the-throne destiny reserved for women. Nor did she conceal her rage at aspects of Nero's private life. She no doubt hoped that he would be more like his grandfather Germanicus than his father Domitius, Agrippina's first husband, who had been notorious for his coarseness and brutality. But Nero disappointed her, and she made it known. Then he began to fear her. He murdered Britannicus, by poison, in front of her eyes, to forestall any attempt she might make to follow through on her foolish threats to install Claudius's son on the throne. Driven by dread, Nero concocted a series of elaborate plots to get rid of her. Mixing comedy with tragedy, he had a collapsible boat built, which precipitated her into the Bay of Naples. Agrippina was injured, but she swam ashore. Terrified that the people would rally to her support, he dispatched one of his most reliable thugs. In one of the great dramatic scenes from history, Tacitus describes how the murderer and his helpers surrounded Agrippina in her bedroom under the flickering lamplight. As the assassin raised his sword, she bared her belly and cried, "Strike here!" pointing to the womb that bore Nero. The tragedy of Agrippina was in a sense unavoidable. Roman women could become doctors, run shops, practice law, and even fight in the arena, but they could not take an overtly political role. Looking back, it seems as foolish and destructive a custom as those the Taliban enforced in Afghanistan in 1999 to exclude women from any sphere of activity outside the home. In both cases, misogyny wasted a potential source of talent. Who could now doubt that Agrippina and her mother would have made competent rulers? But it was unthinkable then, as it still is in many places today, that women should rule. As a result, the insistence on male heirs threw the Roman state into one series of destructive crises after another, which drained men and resources. There would be other powerful women during the 4 centuries that the empire endured after Agrippina's death, but none would ever dare directly challenge, as she had, the political constraints that bound them, or the misogyny upon which they were based. Increasingly, as the empire first waxed and then waned, sensation-seeking became the key to the Roman imagination and its most misogynistic manifestations. Central to that sensation-seeking was the spectacle of slaughter provided on a regular basis by the gladiatorial games. Begun as private displays of valour and skill held at funerals in honour of the deceased, by the imperial period these displays had been transformed into vast, expensive public spectacles of carnage and cruelty. The most famous venue for these contests was the Colosseum in Rome, which could hold up to 90,000 spectators. At its opening in AD 80, 5,000 wild animals were slaughtered during 100 days of hunts and gladiatorial combats. Women occasionally took part in the gladiatorial contests. One relief shows 2 women combatants who fought under the names Amazonia and Achillea confronting each other. They are not wearing helmets because the spectators wanted to see their faces. A whole section of Juvenal's 6th Satire expresses the usual mixture of outrage and fascination at the spectacle of women training to fight. How can a woman be decent, sticking her head in a helmet, denying the sex she was born with? These are the women who sweat in the thinnest, most flimsy of garments. Even the sheerest silks are too hot for their delicate bodies. Hear her grunt and groan as she works at it, parrying, thrusting. What is supposed to be an expression of disapproval conveys instead the lust for the woman who transgresses. But more often, women in the arena were there as victims, not protagonists. Because of this, the Colosseum, while not known as a monument to misogyny, can lay claim to having played a role in the history of that hatred, however accidentally. Convicted criminals were fed to wild animals in the arena during interludes between the more interesting gladiatorial contests. Special horrors were reserved for women convicted of murder. From the 2nd century AD comes one fictional account that seems to be based on real events. A woman convicted of murdering her husband and children was tied spread-eagled to a luxurious bed in the middle of the arena, ready to be raped by a jackass. Hungry lions waited in the wings to finish her off. This spectacle was put on by popular demand. Some women were raped to death in the arena during the recreation of mythological scenes, usually enacting one of Zeus's numerous assaults in animal form on a mortal female. Sexual fantasies about animals mating with women are common throughout human history. A battery of social, psychological, and moral mechanisms usually keeps our fantasies, the unusual and the mundane, separate from our ability to realize them. But in Rome, the border between even the most violent fantasy and reality was breached on such a regular basis that it became commonplace to enjoy the most sadistic spectacles imaginable. The immediate impact of this on the male psyche is well documented, at least anecdotally. Prostitutes are said to have done a roaring trade under the arches of the Colosseum after the bloody games had concluded. While the Roman mob satiated itself, the late empire staggered from crisis to crisis. In the turmoil, a new religious movement was gathering strength. Christianity would dramatically change first the empire, then the world and the lives of its inhabitants forever. In a corner of the ruined Colosseum, now one of the most popular tourist attractions in the world, stands a black cross, which millions of visitors gaze at each year. It is a memorial to the Christian martyrs who died there. Many, if not a majority of these, were women. Ironically, the religion they were devoted to was to play a crucial role, unparalleled to this day, in the history of misogyny.